Growing concerns about oil and gas supplies create an opportunity for alternative energy sources. A four-year-old California company has found a way to make solar panels affordable. But as NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, you cannot get them unless your state offers incentives for clean energy.
Solar City lets its customers lease solar panels. They don't have to shell out a lot of money up front to buy them. Customers often pay less for leases and their electric bills than they used to pay for their electric bills alone. The company is expanding into New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. Solar City CEO Lyndon Reeves says all these states offer rebates and tax incentives for installing solar panels.
A key thing for us when we move into a market is, can we save a business or a homeowner money? And if there's no local incentive, you can't do it.
Massachusetts offers rebates, loans, and tax breaks. It also requires utilities to produce about 1% of their electricity from solar. As a result, homeowners and companies end up getting discounts on solar panel installations. This all sweetens a 30% federal tax credit. Rick Sullivan is Massachusetts Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs. He says Solar City's announcement is more proof that the incentives are paying off.
The companies are coming into Massachusetts. Existing companies are growing in Massachusetts, and they're creating jobs. They're becoming a very important part of the economy.
Solar installations in the state are up 20-fold, and prices are coming down. Sullivan says the goal is for economies of scale to kick in and make solar panels affordable without the incentives. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here for our video pick of the week. Welcome, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have we got this week?
This week we've got something really special on tap. We have a double creature feature. The best kind of double feature, if you ask me.
Of course, a double creature feature.
So the first one has to do with a mystery that's bugged researchers for decades. For longer than that. I mean, it's about the flea and how the flea jumps.
Well,
what's to know?
I mean, flea jumps. What's the big mystery here?
Apparently, the big mystery in the scientific community, this is what keeps people like Greg Sutton and Malcolm Burrows up at night, was whether fleas jump off their knees, it's not really like our knees. They have more joints in their legs, but the knee structure for the flea or the feet.
Do they jump with their feet or with their knees?
How do they and you know,
it
fleas
just keeps people up at night.
Apparently. Yeah. You know, engineers are weird birds. But it turns out that if you watch them with high speed cameras like these researchers did, you can find out exactly how they jump. And you know the amazing, which you can see on our website. And see fleas jumping in slow motion.
But up there, that's our video pick of the week this week, up on the left corner.
It's one of them, yes.
Double creature feature.
So this is the first one. It's this mystery of how fleas jump, and it's really worth a look because they're fleas like you've never seen them before. And really, the amazing thing is just how fast they accelerate. Fleas accelerate at 100 Gs. That's G-force from, you know, the gravitational force. The space shuttle... 3 Gs.
Space shuttle, 3 Gs, fleas, 100 Gs. That's 100 times its weight of acceleration.
It's incredible.
And what? Why doesn't it fall apart?
This is apparently, if you dissect a flea, you find that their internal organs are packed in such a way that they don't slosh around. So, like, they've actually, you know, they're put together.
I hate it when that happens.
They're put together so all their organs are strapped in just like you would be in the space shuttle.
Wow. And on the video that you've made, we can actually see in super slow motion.
Yeah.
And then you've got to compare. I think it's quite interesting to get an idea how fast they do it. You have it compared running at the same rate as a blink of an eye.
Yeah. And the blink looks like you're falling asleep, like you have really drowsy eyelids. It's pretty amazing how quickly these guys are moving.
All right. That was the first creature.
So that's the first creature feature, and that was high-speed photography. And the second creature feature is sort of the opposite. It's time lapse, and it was put together by Max Stone, who we actually have on the line, so he can tell you more about it. Max Stone is a wildlife photographer and field biologist for the National Audubon Society in Tavernier, Florida. Hi, Mac.
Hey, Flora. Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
Mac, tell us a little bit about your awesome video.
Well, the time-lapse video was a project that actually lasted 6 months. It took a lot longer than I anticipated. And the whole project came about from just wanting to take a unique perspective image of these burrowing owls that I found out in Homestead, Florida.
And what are burrowing owls?
Burrowing owls are these diurnal birds. They stand about 8 inches tall. They're these very cartoon-looking creatures with these big, bright yellow eyes, and they have their burrows in the ground. So instead of nesting in trees, they nest underground. And a lot of times they'll excavate their own, or they will take over prairie dogs' burrows or gopher tortoise burrows.
And so how did you capture them? Because the footage on our website, the video that you put together, I mean, they're really up close. You can see those big cartoony eyes. You can look them right in the eyes. It's pretty amazing. But how did you get them?
Yeah, so most of the time when these owls are photographed, photographers will use long lenses. And I really wanted to change it up a little bit, so I used a wide-angle lens. But I ran into so many problems doing this because in using a wide-angle lens, you have to be very close. So fortunately, what I found out after a lot of trial and error was that these owls had become used to road cones sitting next to their burrows.
You mean those big orange things, those
yes,
big cones?
Yes, very alien-looking road cones. They're actually more accustomed to seeing those than they were people. So they used road cones to mark the burrows for when the landscaping company would come through, that they wouldn't mow over the burrows because they're protected birds.
Oh.
So what I did was just cut a hole into the road cone and placed my camera on the inside of it, and the owls were none the wiser.
But how did you get them to look at the camera? Because you have all these shots of the owls looking straight at the camera.
Yeah, well, that was a lesson learned, and it actually took a little while to figure this one out. I kept getting images, you know, hundreds and thousands of images where they weren't looking at the camera, and eventually I rigged my camera to beep just before it would take the photo. So as soon as the photo would take, it would just send out a little beep, and then the owls would turn their heads looking at it to make sure that they were, in fact, looking my direction.
That's really clever.
So instead of smile, look at the birdie, it's birdie, smile, look at me.
Exactly. If I couldn't be there to tell them to smile and make little funny faces at them, at least I could get the camera to do it.
Mac, one quick last question. What's your next project that we can look forward to, I hope?
Well, right now I'm actually working on two projects right now. I'm working with the National Audubon Society here in Tavernier, and we're working on a grant with Disney covering spoonbills, roseate spoonbills, as ecological indicators for the health of the Everglades. So we are putting together videos and still imagery and to do an interactive website about the Florida Bay and the Southern Everglades. So that should be coming about here in the next couple of weeks. And then hopefully, if I can find a nice little perch or a nice place to put my camera so it won't get wet, I'm going to try out a crocodile cam similar to that of the burrowing owl cam.
Ooh, I can't wait for that. Mac, thanks for coming on Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mac Stone's a wildlife photographer and field biologist for the National Audubon Society.
And if you want to see Flora's video pick of the week, go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the photo there, the video on the left.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico has served as a huge experiment. It has allowed scientists to see what oil does to the plants and animals that live in the Gulf, from seagrasses to turtles to giant bluefin tuna. But many of those scientists say their work is being held up. And as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, science delayed, maybe science denied.
After the spill, scientists swarmed over the Gulf like mosquitoes at a summer garden party. Mostly, they looked for bodies, birds, fish, turtles. Universities footed the bill, and the National Science Foundation provided about $20 million for research. The Interior Department and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration sent experts, too. But the real gumshoe work is just beginning. Will wetlands recover? Were tiny fish eggs and larvae wiped out? Will surviving animals reproduce?
It's a huge challenge.
Christopher Dahlia runs the School of the Coast and Environment at Louisiana State University.
You know, in the military talks about the fog of war. In this particular case, we're dealing with sort of a fog of research.
In the military, there are generals, but not in ecological research. Stan Senner is with the environmental group, the Ocean Conservancy.
There really isn't anyone in charge.
True, the federal government scientists are doing some research now, but most of that lies beneath a veil laid down by the Oil Pollution Act. The act calls for research in order to assess damages against those responsible for oil spills. Because that may involve litigation, that research is largely secret.
Dozens and dozens of studies are in the field. Thousands and thousands of samples have been gathered. But that work is largely being held confidential.
Eventually, that scientific data should become public. But Senner and other scientists worry that in the meantime, gaps in the research may go unnoticed without peer review from the larger scientific community. Senner, who worked on the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska, says secrecy sows doubt among the public.
We saw repeatedly in the case of the Exxon Valdez that the people who are most affected by the spill, if they didn't have information, it tended to feed their worst fears.
There is some money for independent open research, the $20 million from the National Science Foundation, for example, but that money runs out soon. And Christopher Dahlia points out that now is a bad time for research money to dry up.
We're going to have an interesting time in the springtime because we're about to come into the season when life starts teeming in the coastal waters. So one of the big issues that I'm concerned about is what's going to happen to the food chains, the food webs, off the coast of Louisiana in particular, where the oiling was the heaviest.
Ironically, it's BP that has spent the most for independent open research. Shortly after the spill, BP gave several universities and research groups in the Gulf about $50 million, with the promise of another $450 million over 10 years. BP and the Gulf states picked a board of scientists to decide who gets the money. Rita Colwell, a life scientist at the University of Maryland, is head of the board.
We are gathering the data to be published in the open literature, and anybody can use it. Private individuals, BP, federal government, anyone.
But the other $450 million that BP promised has not materialized. Colwell says recruiting the research board and writing ethical rules for research took a long time. The board still has not published guidelines for how to apply for money, so it could be months before scientists see any of that $450 million. And that worries scientists like Don Bosch, who sits on the official oil spill commission that's investigating the event. He says the slow start has already compromised the research effort.
Because we had much more limited effort to go out and actually describe the effects of the spill and track the oil when it was actually coming out of the bottom of the Gulf.
Scientists say they need to be out in the Gulf now, and they need someone to organize all independent research going on. They cite the case of herring in Alaska's Prince William Sound. 4 years after the Exxon Valdez spill, scientists thought the population had recovered, but they failed to read all the signs. The population crashed and has never recovered. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
A major new survey of the world's coral reefs finds they are in big trouble. The reef's survival is in doubt because the world's oceans are getting warmer and more acidic. And, as NPR's Richard Harris reports, humans are to blame.
Coral reefs are spectacular ecosystems, overflowing with diverse and colorful marine life. They're also the source of food and economic sustenance to 500 million people around the world. Loretta Burke from the World Resources Institute is on a scientific team that has just finished measuring their health.
Currently, we find 75% of the world's reefs are threatened by the combination of local and global threats. By 2030, the percentage will rise to 90%. By 2050, virtually all reefs will be threatened.
Many of the risks are familiar and long-standing. At a news conference today, Burke talked about overfishing, runoff of sewage, and sediments from the shore.
But perhaps the most short-sighted threat to reefs is the use of destructive fishing practices, the use of poisons to stun and capture fish, the use of explosives to kill fish.
The report also folds in global threats. Greenhouse gases pouring into the atmosphere from our tailpipes and chimneys warm the oceans, causing heat stress to corals. Lots of that carbon dioxide also dissolves in the ocean, creating carbonic acid, which can eventually corrode coral and other shell-building animals. Add it all together, and Nancy Knowlton from the Smithsonian Institution says one-third of all coral species are at risk of extinction.
This makes corals the most endangered animal on the planet, even more endangered than frogs, which have gotten a lot of press because of the diseases that have wiped out a lot of frog populations. And of course, this is just the corals. It doesn't really count all the things that depend on corals.
These are dire projections.
Again, Loretta Burke. She says it doesn't have to be this way.
These results assume no improvement in management, no reduction in local threats, and that we continue on our current trajectory of greenhouse gas emissions.
And that current emissions trajectory does give us a small grace period, says Nancy Knowlton.
The tipping point comes sometime between about 2040 and 2050, which is not that far away.
Local threats are potentially easier to deal with, and there has been some progress in that regard. For example, President George W. Bush created vast marine protected areas in the Pacific to preserve reefs in U.S. territorial waters.
We obviously need more marine protected areas, not just big ones like these, but also small ones, local ones, like where has been mentioned in the Philippines and elsewhere in the developing world, where major marine protected areas are not financially possible, but small marine protected areas can do a lot of good.
In releasing this report today, the World Resources Institute got help from one of the premier marine biologists in this country, Jane Lubchenco, who now runs the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
It will take a Herculean effort to reverse the current trajectory and leave healthy ocean ecosystems to our children and grandchildren.
Nobody sounded too optimistic about that task. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is NPR.
The administrator of BP's $20 billion fund to compensate oil spill victims is on the defensive. The claims are as Kenneth Feinberg. He's facing a wave of criticism about the slow pace and low amount of payments. Here's a sense of the scale of the issue. Low payments mean he's paid out only $3.5 billion. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Twin sisters Sheila Newman and Cheryl Lindsay have seen their once thriving beach wedding business nearly go under since the oil washed ashore in Orange Beach, Alabama last summer. Brides canceled and fewer booking this year. Newman says they've lost two-thirds of their business.
It's hard to put a dollar figure on it because we've lost a lot.
NPR has been following the sisters' struggle to get paid since last August, when we found them begging a BP claims adjuster to look at their case.
We're closing our doors. We're losing everything we have within the next week. We need help today.
BP never paid. The wedding planners closed their storefront and operated from home. Both took on second jobs to pay the bills. When Ken Feinberg took over managing the claims process, they were hopeful they would recoup the $240,000 they'd lost. 6 weeks later, the check came. It was for $7,700, a fraction of their claim. Newman says there was no explanation of how Feinberg came up with that figure.
I think he's just trying to wear everybody down. They'll take such a small amount and just give up. And they sign that dotted line that they're not going to sue. I think that's his goal.
For most spill victims, Feinberg is offering final settlements of twice 2010 losses based on assumptions that the Gulf would fully recover by the end of next year. Newman says she's not signing anything until business is back to where it was before the oil spill. The wedding planners are opting instead to file interim claims every 3 months. But they're frustrated that they haven't received any money since September. And they're not the only ones.
The people of the Gulf Coast are sick and tired of being lied to time after time after time.
That's Alabama Congressman Joe Bonner. The Republican is part of a growing chorus of lawmakers pressuring Feinberg to get more money flowing. Bonner says when President Obama announced that Feinberg would take over, everyone thought he would be an advocate.
And yet what we've seen, it looks like, is a miser hoarding the money to protect BP's interests while these innocent victims continue to just struggle and hope. It's almost like they want us to say thank you when they give us a crumb off the king's table.
A New Orleans federal judge ordered Feinberg to quit saying he's independent from BP, given that the company pays his law firm $850,000 a month. Even the U.S. Justice Department wants to see payments stepped up. In a letter, Associate Attorney General Thomas Pirelli said Feinberg's job is not to return money to BP, but to help people struggling after the oil disaster. But in court filings and at Gulf Coast meetings, Feinberg defends his program and the $3.5 billion he's paid out as nothing short of extraordinary.
We are doing something right.
That's what he told members of the Florida legislature last week. Representative Doug Broxson of Gulf Breeze disagrees.
You have created the perfect system to frustrate our constituents and not pay.
Feinberg says he's getting complaints from both sides. BP says he's being too generous, while local officials say he's being tight-fisted.
I agree that there's a great deal of frustration, and I come back down here and listen to these concerns. The idea that the Gulf Coast Claims Facility is not serving the people of Florida is simply untrue. There are problems that need to be fixed.
It's already too late for many businesses.
Real estate broker Allison Davenport is the vice chair of the Chamber of Commerce in Perdido Key, Florida. She's spearheading an effort to get the White House's attention.
If somebody tapped you for the job, they could untap you for the job.
Davenport says it's time for President Obama to step in and make a change. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.